Hi, Kev, how's it going?
Hi, Owen. It's great to be back.
So you got two new books out, right? You're getting pretty prolific, right? Was this up to 20 altogether?
19 now, I think. Runs in the family, as you know. Well, there's two of them. The first one came out in the spring, and it's called Memoirs of a Revolutionary, but it's not exactly a biography. It has stuff in there about my life over the last 50 years. But what it is looking at the development of the modern world over the last 50 years since 1971 to today, and really understanding what is it in the world that created the modern corporate COVID police state, and looking at that.
What was it in 71 that prompted you to begin there? Is that something personal or something global?
I used my experience when I was 15, when I first began to come into really political awareness about the world and everything that year. I had made a trip to Greece and been arrested by the military there when I was 15. And it kind of gave me a quick education about the world. But also in that year, it was interestingly right about the same time the post-war world economy began to go into a recession. And there was a whole change in the system that happened over subsequent decades starting there. So it was a good date to use in terms of personally and globally, you know, big changes that started, right?
Well, what did the Greek police pin you for?
I described it at the start of the book. I was there with a friend, my friend Charlie Elliott. His mother was an archaeologist, and we were out on the island of Lesbos, which is just off the Turkish coast. And we were two young 15-year-old guys kind of hanging around. And I had my camera, and I wanted to be an archaeologist. In fact, later in life, I trained in archaeology before I went into the ministry. And I was fascinated. I mean, here's this island just off the Turkish coast with all these old ruins. So I began to climb over walls and take pictures. Next thing I knew, this Greek army jeep showed up with three guys with machine guns. Now, at the time, there had been a military coup in Greece in 1967. They had overthrown the government and locked up thousands of their people. In fact, on all these beautiful, idyllic Aegean islands we were passing, they were concentration camps where a lot of political prisoners were held. So I didn't know anything about the military junta in Greece at the time. But these three guys show up with guns. They started yelling at me in Greece because it turns out that I had crossed over a fence of a military observation point. Because they're watching the Turkish coast naturally, right? Because they're traditional enemies. Right. And they took me up to this guardhouse, and they handcuffed me to a chair. I mean, you know, this was pretty frightening for a young teenage boy from Canada, right? But I kept my cool. They began to talk to me, and they realized after a while I was just this dumb Canadian tourist, and eventually let me go after stealing my camera, right? But it really made me, it was kind of like a cold shower realizing, you know, you can have an abstract view of the world, as we've talked about, but when it hits you personally, then you have to wake up to more than what you thought was going on. Right?
I feel like there's a deliberate polarization between, you know, the culture we have with Sesame Street and Play School or whatever, you know, in the media and the culture, and, you know, that sort of real world experience that you had when you're 15. I mean, it took me a little longer to get to where you were at that point. But they suspected that you were perhaps a Turkish spy with a camera. And so they literally interrogated a 15-year-old, you know, tied him to a chair.
Yeah, well, they were talking to me in Greece. They didn't know English. And then after I kept saying Canada, England, you know, and they finally got it. And they let me go. But it was more like after that, I saw the world in kind of a different way, right? I remember the year I went back to Vancouver, that same year, I joined a student rights group for the first time. And we began to, you know, agitate for equal rights for high school students and that kind of thing. And that led me into politics. So it was really a spark. Just like I remember this on the same trip, coming around the corner in Athens, and suddenly there was the Acropolis in front of me, right? And it just blew me away. I had this sudden sense of how insignificant I was, right? This little blip in time. And there's all this history. And people said, well, that's where democracy began, right? The idea that people could govern themselves. And to me, it just all suddenly came together. I felt responsible for the first time for things around me, for the world. And that trip definitely sparked it, right?
what kind of regime? I feel like there's huge gaps in my historical knowledge. But so Greece from 67 onwards, was this a communist regime?
No, it was a military. There was his name was Papadopoulos. He was a Greek politician, and they were fairly, mildly left wing. They had brought in some measures that their traditional Greek army didn't like. You know, they wanted to pull out of NATO for one thing, right? They wanted more independence and all that. And the CIA organized a coup there in 1967. There's a good film done by it called Zed. And it was about the military coup there. But they ruled until the mid-70s, and then the military stepped down and they had, you know, elections for the first time in that. And it was just one of these, yet another CIA coup that led to a lot of repression, right?
Right. So they could put a puppet guy in charge, right, and that they could control and coerce.
Yeah, it was called General Papadopoulos, and he didn't last more than a few years. But, in Chile or Indonesia they figure the CIA has been responsible for the death of over 20 million people since it was established, right?
And then that book then develops chronologically, right, through the 50 years.
What I do in it, Owen, is I take it decade by decade. Okay. So I look at the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and kind of in the overview, I can see by tracing it back how when the 1990s arrived, there was this big shift in the system where traditionally, you know, the whole global economy would go through booms and busts. It was kind of like this all the time, right? But every time the crash happened, the system, the money got more concentrated. The corporations got bigger. So by the time in the 1990s, we had entered the age of the mega corporation, where I look at the statistics I list in there show that over half of the biggest economies in the world weren't countries anymore. They were corporations. Right. And there's an amazing statistic. By 1990, something like 120 companies controlled the world economy, but they only employed less than 1% of the workforce. So it's like, what do we do with everybody else? Suddenly all these people in the system are redundant. And that's what led to the COVID police state, because what happened eventually, they realized big money said, look, we're bigger than governments. We don't need them anymore. And you had the corporatocracy set up where literally, as we see with the whole big pharma thing, why are all the politicians in the world all saying the same thing? You got to get the shot, right? Well, that's because they're answering to the same mega corporation. You know, so I traced kind of the history of how that came about, you know, politically and economically. And it's amazing. I mean, one statistic too, the traditional power in the world in Europe and North America has gone right down the tube. The biggest economies now are in the Philippines, in Brazil, in Vietnam, China. Their growth rate is going through the ceiling. And do you know that 2/3 of all the world production is now in the Indo-Pacific region, like the Indian Ocean, Southeast Asia, India. Like, it's amazing. There's been this huge power shift in the world, right?
And this isn't China. It's not an organic progression, right? This is a deliberate cultivation in that area for specific geopolitical reasons, right?
Right. Well, it has to do with China, right, because that's their whole sphere of influence. And they are now kind of like where America was after World War II. Okay. England had declined. America was coming up. Same thing. America's going down. China's got, they own half of the American debt. Their military is about to outstrip the Americans. Their GDP is twice the size now. And Russia's trying to play a balancing act, right, between the two. So it's like what Orwell predicted in 1984. It's come about, you know, the three power spheres maintaining the illusion of war between each other to control their own populations. And the COVID thing is amazing. It could have been predicted decades ago that, and in fact it was, you know, they said the one thing that people will most willingly surrender their rights over is a public health crisis. They've shown that over the years, that you can take away any rights people want and they'll agree with it if you say they're going to die from a health hazard, otherwise a super bug, right? So you know, it's not at all surprising what's going on. The problem is people are looking at only one scale of the dragon, you know, rather than the whole beast. And that's what I try to do in the book.
And this COVID narrative is covering up for a massive collapse of economic confidence, right? I heard a quote just the other day that the global economy is a sort of zombie phantom being on a life support machine since the 2008 credit crunch crash. And that, you know, over that time since the Second World War, the distance from any kind of material reference point of economies is distancing again and again and again as this illusory shell, you know, disintegrates before us. So the COVID state had to come in to bring about that emergency situation to maintain that centralized corporate power that's, you know, economically about to nosedive, you know, disintegrate, right?
Yes. And, you know, in fact, every time a crash happens like that, it's deliberate. Like, people are saying, why are the government, like in Canada, for example, all the businesses were closed. So the government starts subsidizing people not to go to work. So why are they deliberately bankrupting the country? Because it's creating a huge debt. Well, that's so that China can buy up the whole place quickly, but not just China. Depressions traditionally in the whole history of capitalism going back 300 years, depressions are deliberately created so that the smaller businesses die and the bigger ones can grab them up. That's how they sustain their system. So the system keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, fewer and fewer people controlling everything, right? And
You pump currency into the with a boom time. You pump the currency into the system, irrigate the land, if you like, and then all this illusory mathematics is swishing around. Then you turn the taps off, and you say, right, you're in debt, everybody, and because you can't pay back the debt because you borrowed too much or whatever, because we turn the taps off and there's no economic sustenance left. So we'll take all your real world assets. It's an asset grab, right?
Right. And that's what the whole Keynesian welfare state economy did. It would step in when the system was failing and artificially sustain it. Keep up demand, keep up consumerism so the goods you can, because traditionally capitalism tended to have their crashes because there was overproduction. They produced too many goods and people couldn't buy them. And so you had a slump, unemployment, inflation, all that, right? But now, after the war, it was sustained by a huge global arms economy, right? That's why all these wars were happening, like in Vietnam and that, because you would take that excess capital that would have fueled the recession and pump it into arms. Because think, they're always being used up. It's a constant demand. But that stopped working by the time of the 80s and 90s because the system was just getting too huge. So they needed to think in mega terms. And governments don't exist anymore. We see that. It's all a reflection of the big mega corporations. So one day there'll be that. One day, quite soon, there'll be this the mega corporation that everybody works for. And that's what they're conditioning. The COVID is a Trojan horse, right, to get everybody in that state of mind. Then they'll stop the COVID measures, but people will be little components of that machine and they won't have to worry anymore. So that's obviously the game plan. But people are thinking in old terms, like how do we go back to our quote freedoms, right? I mean, it's part of the illusion.
And part of the illusion is, I was listening to a guy talking about Australia today, but I think this translates all over the world, that the governments, I think it was mid-70s with Australia, have signed the papers to become corporations, right? As with police forces, as with law courts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That these corporate chameleons are masquerading as previous nation states, right?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, you have to see through the camouflage to what's really going on and to understand the nature of what we're in. I mean, that's philosophically, that's how you begin with anything about your life. You have to know the nature of who you are and what you're in. Otherwise, you never get clarity about anything. So that's what I tried to do in that first book and weave it into the events of my own life to almost illustrate. Like, you know, for example, when I was fired by the United Church in 1995, what it initially prompted, it wasn't about Native residential schools. It's because I found out about the church grabbing land from the natives and then selling it off to these big logging companies, right? But right at the same time, the logging company that had being responsible for the land grab that I had notified the church about, that I learned about, they had been going through a huge slump in the economy, and they were Weyerhaeuser, the U.S. multinational, the largest logging company in the world, did spot up this British Columbia company using native land that I found out about. So I had to be gotten rid of because it was a $2 billion deal to consolidate the logging industry along the lines we're talking about. So in fact, I was part of that bigger drama of what we're discussing, the growth of the mega corporations, right? So anyway, that's what I talk about in there.
So in terms of consolidating and centralizing this power globally, you're saying that the 80s was a boom and bust stage to basically shake it up. And then the 90s was that sort of gelling together.
Well, the 80s, if you remember, yes, Reagan and Thatcher, their whole thing was they were trying to revive the Cold War. They were Reagan got in on extreme paranoia about the Soviet Union foreign policy program, right? And Thatcher was kind of little mini-me, just echoing him all the time. But what they also did is they trashed the Keynesian welfare state. And they had to fund the new arms race. And so that's when everything began privatizing, what they call, right? Taking public assets and handing over to a few people. What that was also doing, though, was brainwashing people to equate corporate interest with public interest for the first time, saying, what's good for General Motors is good for all of you, right? And so it was starting to make the transition to the corporatocracy we're in now. It isn't just economics in the abstract. You always have to condition the population to think along new terms, right?
Over here, I remember it as a teenager, the discourse concerning privatization and public ownership was a hot potato, if you like. And, Thatcher particularly, was the one initiating all these, private sector competition was the big word, right? The buzzword. If there's competition, it keeps everything, fresh and dynamic, I think was perhaps the word they used. Right. And so they were basically selling off everything that the nation state owned into these corporate power. And then you've got, issues of constitution that they got corporate policies, but that's got no connection to representation of we the people, right? So they can do basically what they want because they were
creating a new, they were taking the corporation and making it a power unto itself for the first time, legally and politically. They said the rights of companies supersede that of a nation or individuals. So again, it was that massive reconditioning of people. Like after World War II, my dad was saying, suddenly, literally in 1 month, the big enemy became not Germany anymore, but Russia. And they were all this paranoia they had, or all the determination to overthrow Nazi Germany suddenly was focused on Russia as the big enemy, right? And it happened so quickly, and yet everyone went along with it because a part of that thing that you see going on now, which is the group psychosis, and it just transfers from one enemy to another, but it's the same process going on, right?
Right, the group thinks the herd mentality, and so the media then overnight flick the perceived enemy away from a European nation state, because the overarching plan, right? You get into Albert Pike and the letters he was writing as a Grand Master Freemason in the late 19th century, 1800s, shows us that the Orwellian idea of these continental blocks had Germany and the rest of Europe very much in a European NATO, right? It was NATO. So overnight they had to flick the switch in the public perception that Germany was no longer, a threat or an enemy, and that Uncle Joe Stalin, who'd been, everybody's favorite uncle on the Eastern Front for so many years, was now the big villain bogeyman for everyone to fear.
That's right. And, it's like with anything, you follow the money. And one of my friends said the other day, well, it's like if you were a peasant in England around 1600, you were losing all your traditional lands because the wealthy wanted to grow wool. It was one commodity that England could outcompete everybody in. So they enclosed the land. These 1,000-year-old rights of the people to have common land, the commons, where you could graze and fish and everything together. Nobody owned it. But suddenly it's fenced off so that the local landowner could raise sheep. And that created incredible suffering and poverty, but it was deliberate because that people who were then thrown off their land, they went into the cities, they became the new industrial workforce. But if you were a peasant back then and you tried to resist that, it was almost hopeless because it's what the economic system was imposing on the whole world, right? It was a transition. And we're going through the same thing now. It's not like you shouldn't resist it, but you got to look at what's causing it historically. And the direction we're going is not back towards, you know, what we knew, due process, democracy. The system doesn't need that anymore. It needed industrial capitalism. It needed that front, that appearance of democracy, but it doesn't anymore. So there's no point having protests and petitions and elections, and it's gone. It's just, it doesn't exist anymore. We have to fight on in a new way and look at things in a new way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, just this weekend, there's been an awful lot of marches, you know, particularly London, and you see it, and you see this, you know, power base of people that are there, you know, the state militia are absolutely swamped in terms of numbers and the ratio, but they all go home at the end of the day, and the objective is nothing. There's nothing that's changed apart from that sort of good feeling that there's lots of us, and you know, we all think the same, right? So that herd mentality group thing, you know, we brought it up a couple of weeks ago, the biblical demon of legion, has its pros and cons, right?
You're right. Now, all those 500,000 people or whatever were in London, okay?
More, yeah.
As long as they're thinking in the box, they might as well be five people. It doesn't really make any difference.
They're still requesting to the authorities.
Right. They're asking for something. And then they go back into their boxes. Now, if even 10 of those people thought in a different way and detached mentally, their bodies would follow. You know, that old line from Platoon, free your mind, your ass will follow. I mean, once your awareness of the system is there and you pull out, if 100 people in the crowd had started actively pulling their energy out, it would have achieved more in the system than those 500,000 protesting. So it's a matter of reaching all those people, organizing them locally, because that's where our power is. In their neighborhoods, get 10, 20 of them together and start doing like we've done all over the world now. Set up your own assemblies. Think outside the box. What are we going to create? What laws are we going to pass now? And their whole system collapses at that point, and they know it. So that's why, frankly, a lot of the, you know, when we talk about operatives and black ops and all that, they're the ones saying, come on, let's go protest. Come on, let's go, you know, do a petition, because it keeps everyone's energy focused in the box and not in themselves and in their own communities. Right.
Right. They know how to defend against that. Right. It was interesting. You know, the pictures that you see, the reels and the footage, you see a small group of police and literally, you know, sees hundreds and, you know, thousands of people swamping these police, and they've got their batons on the shoulder. And you're thinking, wow, you know, if I was the commanding officer or whatever of those police, I would never, with their best interests at heart, I would never put them in that situation, you know, where they're, you know, with their backs to the gates of Parliament or 10 Downing Street where the Prime Minister's, and, you know, basically leave them at the mercy of a huge, huge crowd. Right? But then I'm thinking, oh, perhaps that's because if they did get, you know, kicked to the ground, then that would be great from the TV pictures perspective. You know, we'll sacrifice right. these cops for the footage for the BBC News or whatever to say, look, right. violence at the protests, these awful, yeah, yeah. you know, members of the public have injured these good upstanding policemen. And so, you know, now we've got to go and, you know, persecute and well, police state the public more.
Right? Sure. But when you look at the way revolutions happen, you know, all those people in the crowd should have spoken to the police and said, take your uniform off.
What?
Disavow your oath of allegiance to the crown. Take it to our local republic assembly. You win over the police and the soldiers. That's when revolutions yeah. happen.
Right? Well, thankfully, there seemed to be a couple of, you know, good talkers there who basically ushered them away. You know, go and do your police work elsewhere. Yeah. this ain't a safe place for you. And so off they went, right? Which was a good, you know, right. merciful collusion.
we don't want to discourage those gatherings. Every now and then, they're very necessary manifestations of look at our power. And we talked about this before. When you can see your power in a battle, you're strengthened. Your morale goes right up. If you can't, if you're isolated sitting there and you can't see who's around you, you give away your power, you lose, your morale plummets. And we have to create those situations. But then we have to say, this is only step one. How do we take back the power for ourselves? Right.
So a question that I had was, you know, is it even necessary to, you know, get into the Houses of Parliament? You know, do we need that building and those offices with which no. to get to the next stage of where we're going, right?
They don't have power anyway.
We don't need those buildings, right? We can do them, you know, in Milton Keynes or something.
Well, I remember when Tony Benn, you know, he was Chancellor of the Exchequer and of the Labour at one point. He said, as soon as I got into office, I got a call from a representative of the International Monetary Fund. And he said, now that you're in office as a Labour government, here's what you're going to do. And he had to do it. I mean, you know, the banksters, they determine. So, I mean, they're just the front of the, and we all know that now. People know that, right? But they still kind of spasmodically go through the conditioned response of marking a ballot because that's all they know, right? But again, that's programming. And it's the hardest thing in the world to consciously break from your programming unless you have an alternative that people can belong to. And it's building that alternative that's the challenge now, because every time we try to make that step, you get this wall of resistance from people. And that's why the enemy isn't out there. Just look in the mirror, people. What's holding us back, right?
It's that programming of needing to be under authority, right? We've said this before, but you're looking for leadership from the age of 4 years old, 5 years old at primary school. We're conditioned and programmed to do as we're told, to obey the authority figure. Yeah. So I don't know if you catch this kind of news, but there was also a by-election very recently where, you know, one constituency does a little election to see whether, you know, they're going to stick with their party political representative or change. So that's controlling the narrative, right? There's all this, you know, swell of rebellion in the air. But the news is saying, oh, have a little look over here. You know, we've got a little party debate going on. Is it going to be the Conservatives? Is it going to be Labour? You know, what's going to happen? And it draws everybody's attention back into that old sort of systemic way. And the other little thing happening over here is that Boris Johnson had a party last year when there was, you know, lockdown, which is basically, again, predictive programming conditioning saying, hey, everybody, you're not allowed to have parties. But everybody's saying, oh, Boris broke the rules. So this is, you know, cult of personality aspect to how the news is drawing people in, you know, that throw the popcorn back and look at the villains, you know, being naughty and we can scream at them how vile they are or whatever, but which completely deflects away from, you know, the enormous global issue that's going on where, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are being mass murdered via medical malpractice. Well, again, far too generous a phrase.
Again, it's nothing new. I mean, you know, it's like working with Native people has always been so, it was like my trip to Greece when I was a teenager. You enter another world and they say, well, they've been shoving needles in our arms for 150 years in Canada under the Indian Act. You can't refuse an injection or you go to jail. What's new about this? He said, now you're all on the Indian reservation, right? Welcome. And it's interesting because you couldn't get off the reserve without a special pass, like the quote vaccine passports. It's like, is this the same old program being now reissued? But what is strange, and we've talked about this before, is why are they so overconfident, the people behind the whole COVID thing, that they're shooting themselves through the head by doing this, because they're alienating massive numbers of people. And you never do that. You don't rule by making a lot of enemies, but by hitting people selectively. Targeted groups like Indians, you know, you can take them out because nobody cares about them, right? But now everybody is, you know, including cops, are expected to get this shot. So, you know, all that's doing is creating a massive opposition. Right. And yet they're not worried about that, apparently. Why? Okay, that's the question. They are confident that their technology will so control people's minds that they don't have to worry about that anymore. And so to me, the question is that true or isn't? Is that just a black op idea they planted to keep people afraid, or is it the reality that people's minds are too controlled now for there to be any kind of real resistance? Question.
Yeah, well, the research does point to this artificial intelligence hive mind control via these technologies that are being injected into us, right? So, you know, this is, it's a really interesting question. But on the other hand, you know, Sun Tzu, right? When your back's to the wall, act confident and talk brash, right?
You have to fight. You don't ever push anybody's back to the wall. And you see that all over, right? It's reflected in the number of people who are in that London protest, right? If they were all mind controlled, what are they doing out there?
Right.
You kind of look at the hard evidence all the time and not what you're reading on the internet. The hard evidence is they're not controlled, or they'd be too afraid to protest. They'd all be sitting in front of their little computers and five people would show up at the protest. But that's not what's going on. Yeah. So look at the evidence. It shows, in fact, they don't have things under control. Right.
And there seems to be an inverse flip, if you like, with regards to, you know, previously, historically, they've sat back quite benignly and waited for attacks on them. And then they can say, oh, look at the violence, look at the bad behavior by those guys. But that seems to have flipped around now. And they're doing the aggressor role and outing themselves and revealing, you know, losing their aspect of concealment. And so it's easier for those people who see through it all to point out to people who are unsure what's going on, you know, what's going on. Like, here's the evidence, here's the data. They're doing the offensive. They're rolling out their tyrannical aggressive offensive. And, you know, it's so much easier to see, right?
Well, yeah, and that's true generally. Now, the thing is, when you say they are rolling out the offensive, no, we all are. We are all causing it. That's the first thing about self-activation, is you realize nothing's been done to me ever. We have created the whole system. All of us have. Our labor, our taxes, are looking the other way, whatever. And that's why you always go, it's like in the Titanic, you go to the bottom of decks to see what's really going on, not the top decks, right? After the iceberg hits, you know, where the flooding is, by going the furthest down. And that's why working, that was my advantage over the years, working with people really on the outs and marginalized. You could see the trend of what's going to eventually affect everyone. And everyone is responsible for what's going on now. Once you take ownership of that and say, yeah, you can then pull out. But if you're always the victim, you have no power. You always have to ask for somebody. And that's why it isn't just conditioning. It's how we see ourselves as being acted on, or whether now we are going to act. But to act, you have to own what you've done. You have to take responsibility. And rights are easy. Responsibility isn't, right?
So you're saying that in terms of we've paid our taxes in and we've, you know, benignly allowed it to get to where it's got to. But in terms of...
Not even benignly, frankly. We all know that when we buy stuff, what is that stuff on the shelf? How does it get there? We are part of a blood-soaked system that's been that way from the beginning.
Right? 100% agree.
But,
but the differentiation I'm thinking about here is that, you know, the economy is in free fall and our adversaries in a war, right? Our enemies, our opponents are making plays, if you like, or initiatives that we can identify. And so that's you know, chess game, if you like, seems to me to be coming to an end game, and where, or their hand is being forced because of their, desperate situation. Is that fair enough, Wynn?
Well, they're deliberately crashing the system to create what they think is going to be their absolute system that won't ever crash. They want to create this monolith that is not subject to the traditional fluctuations of their economic system, right? The mega corporation. But the problem is they don't understand. You see, they're like Bill Gates. They're technocrats. They're thinking in very artificial terms. In nature, the more you get rid of diversity, the more unstable the system becomes. Diversity is there genetically and in evolution and in nature as a stabilizing, so that if one part dies, the other can pick it up. So you need massive diversity in nature. That's what has kept us around for, you know, hundreds of millions of years. But what they're doing is abolishing diversity. They're creating one monolithic system, and that's more prone to disaster. It's more liable to crash. And when it does, everything comes down, because you don't have, like during the Depression in the 1930s, often the South Sea Islands, they weren't suffering at all because they weren't part of the market economy. But if you plug everybody into that system, and when it goes down, because nothing is immortal, right? When it crashes, everything will die. And it's almost like we talked about this before, this death wish in the system, right?
Okay.
Why would you create a system so monolithic that when it crashes, it takes the whole planet with it? It's because it's not just the logic of the system playing out. It's this death wish. People in the system don't really want it anymore, but they're too trapped by it, especially if you're at the top. The more you're in charge, the more trapped you are mentally by it. It's only the people on the margins and on the bottom who have the freedom to create something different. And that's why we always look to them, not the status quo and the people in charge, right? So I think it's part of that whole suicidal complex raging at the high levels of the system, right?
And those high levels of the system are occupied by people in post who have a lot of fear of falling, right? Of paranoia that, you know, they've got to maintain their position, maintain their control because they don't want to be, you know, down in the gutter. They like their inflated, lofty positions, right? So because of the ancient construction of this control grid, whereby people are subservient because of money, perhaps, but also incrimination. Right? When you look at these cults, you know, the Ninth Circle, et cetera, et cetera, people can't be disloyal or they can't break ranks. Otherwise, you know, things get very bad very quickly for them. And that structure of power that's becoming, like you say, an enormous global monolith is also very, very brittle. And as these emergency measures, if you like, are being uncovered and revealed for what they really are, the brittleness of that enormous pyramid, you know, starts breaking up, starts fragmenting, shall we say,
right?
Which I feel like is a very healthy thing, but it leaves that individual psyche bereft. We mentioned this before, bereft of an identity as a worker bee or a drone or you know whatever phrase.
Right. You want. Now that's important because people are essentially lost these days. When you talk to them, it's not about fear of masking or disease. They have no identity, like. The third most common cause of death in the world is suicide, especially among people 18 to 30. Now, that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
People at the peak of their youth, when they are normally optimistic, all want to kill themselves. That's because we live in this corporate system that doesn't have meaning anymore. And there's an essential crisis here of human identity. What is our meaning? Why are we alive?
Because it's traditionally. It's materialism, right? So if the money's drying up and you know the economy is falling away, you can't have that car or that, you know.
Yeah, but that none of that matters. The cars, you see, because it doesn't matter if you have no meaning behind it. If you know traditional societies gave you meaning, that's why like Hutterite colonies, they have the lowest level of mental illness of any society in history, and because. They all belong. They have belonging. They have meaning. They have a trade. They can contribute. You don't have that in the modern corporate world. There is no meaning. It's just it's like my grandfather's song from World War I. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. Like there is no meaning. We're just cogs in a machine. We've been created that way and we see our identity that way, but it's a dead end. We have to create new meaning and you can't do it in the present system. So. It's supposed to come down so we can recover the human soul, basically.
Right, and we can escape the incarceration of this materialist third dimensional world. Right? So people are obsessed with the materialistic aspects, and if they haven't got that, then that's the identity problem, right? They got this identity crisis because they aren't able to live, you know, with money, right? And get all those trappings to present as something that's worth something. But this is a very healthy thing. It's a clearing, you know, healing remedy. Because it's inviting people to have a little think about, you know, what you just mentioned, that there's is a far more wholesome and valuable aspect to life here.
But nobody's going to see that. With, you know, it's like friends I have. They say, help me see. And I said, you can't see in the box. You got to get out of the box first. But it's a wrenching process. It feels like you're dying, right? And people run back into slavery so they don't have to have that death. But it is a death experience. You're going to die to a lot of what you know and go through horrible pain and dark night of the soul But then at the other end, you're going to find yourself again. And that's what we have to encourage in people, right?
It's just the classic metaphor of the butterfly in the popcorn. No, in the cocoon. Right.
Yeah.
Mixing
metaphor. Well, and that actually leads to my second book. Okay. Mind if I talk about it?
Sure. Yeah. Go for it.
Okay. So, you know, as you know, over our many great interviews, there's this massive history, and it's hard to just impart it as facts to people, like, you know, about genocide and all of this stuff. So what I did is I put it in novel form, right? And I wrote a novel based on my own family, and it deals with the past, the present, and a possible future. And it's called Land of Liberty. And, it starts in the past with the attempted rebellion in Canada in 1837 to overthrow the British crown. And great, great, great grandfather, Philip, took part in it. And it's about Philip and his father, Robert. Now, Robert, they came to Canada because his father, Robert, had fought at Waterloo. He was a British army officer in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And, he got all this free land in Canada. And so they immigrated. Now, ironically, his son, Philip, here then takes up arms as a young man to overthrow the British crown as part of what was called the Mackenzie-Papineau Battalion. It took place in Quebec and Ontario.
So and just, it was a revolution. Just to summarize that point, Dad was part of the conquistador colonization as a Welsh Fusilier taking the land. And then son was the revolutionary opposite.
No, yeah. Well, Robert Annett was in England. They live in Frome in Wiltshire was the name of the town near Bristol. Yeah, beautiful old place. They lived there. He got an officer commission, fought at Waterloo, and then was, as a retired officer, went to Canada with his whole family. They had like 13 kids, and Philip was the oldest son. And so he was part of that imperial tradition. And in the novel, I actually have a conflict. Robert lives on a farm right next to Philip in southern Ontario near, it's called Watford now. It's near Sarnia and kind of near the American border. And they have a conflict because when the rebellion happens, Robert is against it. And yet he has a family loyalty to his son because the country is run by what's called the family compact. It's a few Anglican bishops, crown appointees and bankers, and they're running the whole country just like now. But they call themselves the family compact. And Mackenzie, who was William Lyon Mackenzie, who led the rebellion in English Canada, and people like my great, great, great grandfather, Philip, they said, no, we need to get rid of the family compact. We need a republic like in America. And they were called, you know, all sorts of nasty names for doing that. There was a similar movement in Quebec under a guy called Papineau, and they almost overthrew the British, but it failed, and a lot of them got hanged. Fortunately, my ancestor didn't. But it talks about that and how it led to today. And it's set up in Canada after the rebellion. They brought in this you know, dictatorship of crown and church that ran everything. That's why they had these residential schools, and the church had such power because of that feudal system they froze in place. And it led to what's now causing the Republic movement. And in the future part of the book, I talk about, okay, we had a revolution, the Republic finally won. Now we got to deal with this corporatocracy that's running the world. And so it's kind of like the Republic versus the mega corporation. That's what the novel's all about. And I had so much fun writing it because I wanted to bring to life the human aspect, not just the dull facts of, you know, mass murder and all that, but how it played out at a family level. Okay. And within my own family, the legends we always heard about Philip, and, you know, the family's still divided over whether that should have happened or not. But anyway, that was the purpose in writing Land of Liberty, which you can get on Amazon and through me.
Well, big book. How many pages?
Well, I've edited down. It's about 550 now. Okay. So it's like full novel length.
And this is on Ontario, right? So from a geographical perspective, is that Prairie Plains?
No, it's Eastern Canada.
Okay.
So in right above kind of New York, you've got Quebec and Ontario.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it took place in both provinces, although they were called Lower Canada back then. That's Quebec, and Upper Canada was the English area, Ontario.
And one thing I've always wondered, so the USA has gone full independence, end of the 1700s. And then Canada's, you know, got this whole British Crown affiliation connection going on. Is that border very porous? Are there a lot of people passing back and forth?
Oh, yeah. Traditionally. Right. Traditionally, it's the longest border in the world.
Right.
Between the US and Canada. So it's, and it's funny the way the culture is, there's an East Coast, it doesn't go horizontal. The culture in North America is vertical. So you've got a West Coast culture, a very Californian, it's the same one, British Columbia. You've got a prairie culture. Farmers in Texas are very much like farmers where I grew up in Manitoba. And then you've got the New York kind of cosmopolitan East Coast culture that embraces both Canada and the US. So that's the reflection that when you look at the speech patterns in English, you know, it really common across North America. It isn't, there isn't really a Canada and the United States in that sense. Those are just artificial boundaries. And same with the native people. Same, the native nations span the borders all over the place, right?
Well, often these borders are specifically put in place to divide tribes, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That was the case with the Mohawks and everybody. Yeah.
And so, when you've got this, you know, difference of regime between the Canadian Crown Commonwealth infrastructure, and you've got the much more pioneering American Constitution, is there a sort of suspicion from the USA that Canada's a Crown state, and you know, perhaps we're looking at being infiltrated from the north.
Right. Well, being half American, my dad's from New Jersey, and so I've had a binational culture my whole life, so I see this really clearly. Your average American in a lot of areas are very suspicious of Canadians for that reason, because you know they're like they don't like the British monarchy. This whole idea that one person can tell you what to do just goes against the American grain, right? The traditional American culture, right?
The whole thing about the Second Amendment with the guns, right, is because the Redcoats attempted to take the weapons away from the Patriots prior to attacking them, right? So the guns is a throwback from the British offensive, right?
Well, back then, it wasn't just to take their guns because everybody was a farmer back then. You needed a gun to survive. If you take away the guns, you starve to death. How are you going to hunt, right? How are you going to defend your farm? So it's a very powerful image to an American. But in Canada, there's a smug old, those, they're all rednecks wanting to go out and shoot their AK-47 at deer, right? But I mean, that isn't the issue, because Canadians say, well, we don't need guns. The government will take care of us and protect us, won't they? You know, that's a very English-Canadian attitude. But again, Quebec is very different. It's more European, French kind of like attitude, right?
Okay. In terms of the French Revolution, authority, right? And then from that perspective, then, after the Napoleonic Wars, you know, the end of the 1700s, the Age of Revolution, if you like, and then there's a real kind of paranoia, hardline lockdown in Canada.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know? I don't know if you know a film called Peterloo, you know, to talk about the family, history aspect. And it follows a young soldier from Manchester who comes back from, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, to Manchester. And you see how this brave guy who's, you know, been fighting for the flag, if you like, of England, is then sees how, you know, at a local level, there's complete, you know, persecution and then also a massacre at this,
Peterloo massacre. Yeah.
The Peterloo massacre.
1819.
Yeah. Peter Field, right, is the kind of name switches to Peterloo to match the Waterloo, right? And basically the hardline authorities, were doing exactly what the French revolted against, right? And so this kid has gone and fought against the French who were, trying to stand up for we the people. And then he goes back home and gets smashed by exactly those same kind of powers and forces that.
You know, and all the, I remember last time I was in Manchester, there's a big, in one of the little halls there, they have a big mosaic showing that, like, these were just poor families that wanted the right to vote. And they had a big rally. And the yeomanry showed up and the cavalry and just chopped them to pieces and killed 200 of them, right? Just because they wanted the right to vote. And that kind of thing went on all the time.
Yeah.
On both sides of the Atlantic, right? Because it was kind of like the French Revolution. Then we've seen the way a virus is now, or you know, the communist scare in the 1950s and all that. It was like this evil thing trying to come in. People shouldn't vote. Or the rulers know what's best for them. It was that whole paternalistic attitude, and still like what you get in Canada today, right? And Britain and other places, right?
I feel like there's an interesting sort of parody metaphor, if like, with this whole narrative of trying to expel a pathogen or a virus from society. And yet, I think, you know, as below, as above, so below, what we're seeing from a societal level is almost like, you know, excuse the the analogy, but squeezing that zit, right? We're trying to excrete societally this tumor that's been, you know, locked into our psyches and our societies for since antiquity, that is mirroring this whole hoax COVID narrative, right?
Well, you know, that's a very apt metaphor, because that's exactly within us individually and as a society, there's a poison and it has to come out. And yet we're fighting it coming out. And in one of the passages in this novel, my novel, my ancestor Philip, his wife Sarah befriends a local Chippewa Native woman, and they're being wiped out. The crown is sending out cavalry to burn out and kill all the Chippewa and burn out their villages to get their land for this thing called the Canada Company, which is a big monopoly, right? And the farmers and the natives are all being targeted. So she befriends this woman, Gizi, Chippewa woman. And Gizi says to her, you people are sick. You've lost your animal spirit. And Sarah says, what's an animal spirit? She said, you left it back across the waters. It's the land you come from. There's an animal guide who tells you the truth and keeps you sane. And you, mukaman, which is the Chippewa word for a white man. It means a thief who comes in and grabs everything. You mukaman are crazy. You're going to go crazy and kill yourselves. And our prophecy says we have to move west to get away from you, because you're all going to destroy yourselves. And then we can come back to our land. And I hear that prophecy all over the native world. The traditional is like, look, you just sit back, because you people are going to destroy yourselves. The important thing for us now is to get out of this sick system, if at all possible, and build something different. But if we carry the sickness here with us, we're just going to replicate it. So we got to really get cured inside. And you do that on the land. You do that back at your roots, you know, with Mother Earth. You don't do that through the internet or medication, right?
You hear as well this word, I think it's from North America, Wetiko, which seems to me to be a different way of saying psychopathy. And so that idea that, you know, our immune systems are being turned against ourselves is happening on a global scale, right? So that's unearthing of these power networks that are very clandestine and covert, yeah, and stealthily operating is getting the treatment is getting revealed and busted by the global population, and you know it's a cleansing excretion process, right?
We always think, and I had bad experience of this as a minister, being a minister too long, because I always want to think in terms of give an alternative for people, give them a way out. But you know, the reality is we might be literally the bad guys, and our time has come, and we do have to come down. Right. And I'm not so much concerned about personal, you know, security or, you know, because it helps when you're in your 60s. You don't worry about that as much. But I mean, in terms of our whole society, it has to come down. And this could be a way it happens. And whether or not we come out the other end, I don't know. Maybe that's not our fate. But we are in a group psychosis right now, exactly like Nazi Germany. And it's not rational. It can't be thought, or we can't get out of it by using the means by which we got into it. That's that old saying that you've got to be recreated before you can create the new. And any way we can do that, I think, is what we have to do. Just don't think in terms of the old psychosis. Just go inside the source of everything. You know, it's within us and our connection to the eternal. And that's our, you know, if there is a way out for us, and I don't know if there is, but if there is, it's got to go that way to get outside their group mod, which is sick and dying, right? If not already dead.
One of the big tumors or kernels of malaise is that Catholic Church Corporation, the Vatican Corporation, right? And you know, I'm really keen to get an update before we close on right. You know, you mentioned there was, I think it was 12, you said, churches that had been burned in North America.
More.
And, you know, that cleansing of this spiritual, pathology, out of, you know, the group, spirituality is got to be a big healing aspect to the whole world, right? Collectively. How's that developing? I remember you saying that the Pope was going to come to Canada, then he changed his mind, then some apples were going to go over Rome, and then that changed his mind. And the latest thing I heard is the Pope's dying, which I don't think I believe.
No, well, that's whenever you hear that, it's a media cover story to cover right. Something they don't want you to see. No, I don't think in terms of healing anymore. Like I say, it's coming down. I don't think it should be healed. But the thing that's happened, it's really funny, actually. First, Bergoglio was going to come to Canada to do his usual apology thing, right? And then we told the Catholic bishops, he'll be arrested and you guys will be arrested because this is a death camp he's going to in Kamloops. And we've got more and more of the evidence of that. And we're going to arrest him. They then back off. The Catholic bishops say to him, no, we don't think you should come right now. But he continues, you know, and so he invites all these native puppet chiefs to Rome. Right. And then their own elders tell them, if you go to Rome, don't bother coming back because you can't come back. You're not part of your own nation anymore. We're going to expel you. So they cancel under the guise of, well, we're concerned about the COVID threat going to Rome, like since when, right? And then Bergoglio's got egg all over his face. So he responds by putting the whole story into media lockdown and basically going into damage control and doing his usual kind of, you know, media PR opportunities to make it look like everything is fine, you know, back in Rome. But the reality is they're in major crisis and there's a new faction that's formed, we've learned, that's probably going to depose him. And like Ratzinger, don't forget, Ratzinger stepped down because of health issues. I mean, it'll be another health issue for Bergoglio, right? It's the simplest lie to tell, and you can't prove it one way or the other, right? But no, there's another palace coup in the works. But the bigger thing is that they're shifting their allegiance east to China. That's why Biden went and kissed the guy's ass in Rome to try to keep him in the Western sphere. But it's part of that bigger global thing we talked about earlier, right?
Yeah, right. So that big corporate monolith that we talked about earlier, does it need the Vatican, or can the Vatican be, yeah, as we spoke about the other day, you know, cut away to the deadwood, jettisoned to clear the decks?
The Vatican does two things. It's a big financial clearinghouse. Lots of the world's money goes through the Bank for International Settlements in Geneva and the Vatican Bank. They're the two repositories of a lot of the world money. So the Chinese want that. Obviously, they just get those assets moved east, basically, or into their network in the Indo-Pacific region where all the economic growth is happening. But the second thing the Vatican does is mind control on a big chunk of the world's population. And they it's like, why do you keep monarchs around? Well, because you got to keep conditioning in people that there's somebody more important than you, that they have authority, that birth alone can confer authority, that a position in on a throne gives them authority over somebody. And that's very important to maintaining the global slave, you know, population, their mentality. So for both those reasons, they're not going to get rid of it. Only we can do that.
I agree. I'm sure there's a bit of a dilemma as to, you know, if we jettison and get rid of you know, royalty or the papal hierarchy, then that would stimulate more of a wake up as to, you know, the change that is in the potential for change and a global shake up. So, you know, they perhaps want to keep the status quo as steady as possible.
Yeah.
To avoid that, you know, that shake up wake up.
Right, because then you take that away, it creates a vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum, right. So do human beings. We'll move into it and set up our own stuff. So they always have to keep the lid on everything, or at least create the appearance that they are, and rely on people's fear and ignorance, which is the only way they really rule them.
But there's revolt in the ranks. I watched, maybe I'll add it at the end of this video, but there was a really interesting nun, you know, very sort of senior, probably in her 70s, 80s. And you know, she had a really high-tech microphone, but still in, you know, traditional black and white. And she was laying into, you know, the hierarchical system of her church, right? So it seems they're cracking, right? Breaking apart. Well,
it's about growing up. It's about saying goodbye to mom and dad and moving out and becoming self-governing and self-responsible. But that's a big task to take on. It's a lot more work. It's like working on a farm. It's backbreaking work every day. So is reclaiming your liberty. But it's the only way to go now. It's that or death, right?
Yeah, well, it really is high stakes now. We're getting that. Okay. Past the hour, Kev. Should we call
this
it?
This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah,
really. And thanks from Philip and all the Annas.
Yes, and can you show us the two books again just before we close? Let's see the two covers. Yeah.
Memoirs of a Revolutionary and Land of Liberty. And so you can get both Amazon or through me, AngelFlower101 at Proton Mail.
So Land of Liberty is the novel, historical novel from the 1800s. And the memoirs is the 1970s, 50 years through.
That's right. Kind of global political economy. And so, yeah, they should be read together. Good Christmas gift.
Yeah. Wow. You've been busy. How long did it take to put those together?
Oh, I've been working on the novel for several months, and this one came about. I had a lot of, it's like with the genocide evidence, I had a lot of stuff already on it. But yeah, this year, those are my two works this year.
And that's your first novel. You haven't written a novel before.
No, I wrote another one years ago, but it's the first major novel. Yeah.
Because I think you're a terrific writer. I hats off and 100% respect your research talents, but I also think you turn a phrase, you know, studied a bit of literature and taught English for a while, and I think you're right up there with the the literary talents of the world. He's terrific.
Well, thanks, brother. Aging,
right?
Everyone's in the family.
Okay.
What?
Okay, we're going to quit. Cheers, Kev.
Thanks a lot, brother. It's been great.
I think we're a bit steadier with the bass, I suppose.
Okay.
Keep it going. Cheers.
Cheers.